Please continue your food while I introduce the speaker, who will be coming on shortly. First, a little bit of housekeeping. If you could, of course, turn your phones to silent so we can give full attention to Dr. Chiron George later. And a mention that next week we've got another fantastic speaker, another academic, Danny Gittings. He'll be talking on testing the boundaries of the Hong Kong Basic Law, and that's on October the 15th next week. My name is Douglas Wong, and I've had the good fortune to be able to work and learn from some great editors at Bloomberg, where I work now, Financial Times before, and around the bar here at the FCC, of course. One of the lessons I do remember was when I was a young, starry-eyed journalist, and it was from a retiring editor at the Singapore Straits Times. "Your editors lie," she said. "Your friends lie, and always remember the government lies. Good luck and keep up the good work." Chiron George is one of the finest journalists I had the pleasure to work with when I was at the Straits Times. And since then, since he left the newspaper, he's taught many bright young things over 9 years how to keep up the good work at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University, where he's been an associate professor of journalism. He's written the definitive book on Singapore politics and also brilliantly described Singapore's media environment in his book, Freedom from the Press. Like all great writing, that book can be appreciated by different readers in different ways. I thought that it made a powerful case for the inevitable, if gradual, change towards greater accountability in Singapore. As so often, it seems I missed the point. As the summary of today's talk says, Chiron will today tell us how Singapore's system isn't restricted to its shores, and its use of coercion, markets, and responsiveness to public opinion is being deployed by the powerful everywhere, to the extent that we don't even question their veracity. I hope you can also offer us a little bit more advice than good luck and keep up the good work. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Chiron George.
Thank you very much, Doug. Douglas actually extended this invitation to me more than a year ago. It was very kind, and it's only been... I've been waiting for him to actually make that concrete. He finally... did so, I'm glad to be here in Hong Kong for a short while, which enables me to finally accept this invitation. I'd like to thank Tara as well and her team for making this possible. I think, Doug, you didn't miss the point completely of my book. I mean, like all good academic books, they don't actually have a point, so you're free to come to any bottom line you choose, and we'll still nod sagely and say, yeah, there's some truth in that. Right? But I hope to summarize some thoughts about the Singapore press system in the next 20 minutes or so. And then I hope that we'll move on to a fairly open discussion, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have about my little island south of here. My interest in Singapore politics has always been first and foremost as a Singaporean who was born there and has lived there for a long time and has seen only one government, the People's Action Party government, since the time I was born, in fact, even before that. Right? This perspective, of course, necessarily differs from the parachute journalists, from the visiting commentators and so on, who, as long as I've remembered, have always come in and gather the impression that this system must be unsustainable. Right? It simply does not make sense that you could have a first world country with a very, very high standard of living, with levels of civil liberties that belong in the backwaters of the world. Right? How is it possible that you could have first world standard of living with third world levels of press freedom and civil liberties? So every commentator goes away convinced that this is a society that is going to crumble under the weight of its own contradictions, and it is only a matter of time. Those of us in Singapore have seen these predictions come and go, right? So we don't really have the luxury of thinking that this is, in fact, a system that is going to change very soon. So I've always been really intellectually engaged with the opposite question. Let's assume that, in fact, this is a system that by some miracle is actually sustainable. So what is it that sustains it? This is not a very popular line of inquiry. In fact, if you Google the term democratic consolidation, you will find a Wikipedia entry on it. There are whole fields dedicated to it. If you Google instead the term authoritarian consolidation, you will find no Wikipedia entry on it. There are few scholars working in this area, including myself, but it is not a particularly fashionable thing to study. The reasons are multiple. Part of it is the feeling that, well, you know, if scholars are going to help newly emerging democracies entrench themselves, that's a good thing. But we certainly wouldn't want to help authoritarian societies entrench themselves. And so there isn't a field called authoritarian consolidation. I think the other reason, of course, is a kind of a democratic hope. The hope that that authoritarianism, by its very evil nature, should not survive. And so we just have to give it time, and it will, in fact, crumble the way the Soviet Union crumbled and so on, right? So I think this is another reason why this idea of sustainable authoritarianism has not been given the attention it deserves. So my analysis of the Singapore media is very much influenced by this desire to try and understand if, you know, contrary to our democratic hopes, maybe this is a regime that actually knows what it's doing. That this is a regime that has somehow chanced upon this formula for keeping itself going, not in spite of media controls, but because of media controls, right? That the two could actually go together. So the question of how is it possible is the one that I hope to answer today, with specific reference to the media, but my observations will extend to politics in general as well. Of course, if you ask any Singapore official, why is it that the People's Action Party has stayed in power too long, they would first of all brush aside the, you know, this inconvenient label of being authoritarian and say that it all boils down to good government. This actually is an observation or a theory that is shared beyond the Singapore government. So I was quite amused, I guess, to see what WikiLeaks had to say about the secret to Singapore government dominance. When WikiLeaks came out, you know, Singaporeans searched for everything, all the cables that referred to Singapore. And there was, in fact, a US diplomatic cable from some years ago that, in fact, did try to identify the deep, dirty, dark secret of PAP dominance. And this is what it says. I've put it up on this slide. This is what a confidential cable from the US Embassy said in 2004, that the biggest challenge to the development of the opposition in Singapore is the PAP's highly successful track record. It has consistently delivered peace, stability, rapid economic growth for decades while avoiding corruption. Right? So even according to these American diplomats writing in secret, there is some agreement that, yes, good governance is in fact part of the formula. Right? And this, of course, is entirely the government's answer to this question of how is it possible that it can be sustained. I'm not really satisfied with this explanation because if you look at it comparatively, it doesn't stand up. I mean, if it were true that good government should lead to passive politics, then you should find a very clear association that would basically say you know, the more effectively a government rules, the higher the quality of life, the higher the standard of living, the less you should see of unruly politics, less protests and so on. But that is not the case. I mean, if you look at, say, the 10 to 20 other societies in the world that have higher standards of living in Singapore, if you look at the societies where Singaporeans themselves migrate to, right, the Canadas, the Australias, and so on of this world, some to Hong Kong. Right? If you look at every indicator that suggests, well, there's a group of countries that are doing better than Singapore, you will find, surprise, surprise, not so surprising after all, that these countries also have more active politics, that these countries that are doing better than Singapore also have a more vibrant political scene, more dissent, and so on. So clearly there isn't this neat relationship between quality of life and absence of protests. So that's why I wouldn't give this theory full credit. Let's look more closely at the Singapore media system. This is a map of the world colored according to press models, fully free, partly free, and unfree. Right, green, yellow, and red. Singapore is one of, it's a little red dot on this map, along with Malaysia, China, of course, and large parts of Africa. So it is classified by most media watchers as an unfree system. I'll tell you a little, describe a little bit about why Singapore is categorized that way. First of all, it has a discretionary licensing system, which essentially means that even if you have the investors, the will, the manpower, and so on to set up a newspaper, you still need government permission to do so. Right? And the government can accept or turn down your request for a permit to publish a newspaper with no reasons given. And in practice, it has not allowed more newspapers to be set up for a long time. Secondly, this should be familiar to those of you working in international media. Singapore has tough defamation laws. It applies contempt of court very strictly. Thirdly, we have strict secrecy laws. There's no Freedom of Information Act, which of course makes life tougher for journalists, lawyers, other activists. On the bright side, there's no prior censorship of the internet. Anyone can set up a website on anything without government permission, like in most countries. And significantly, there's been no blocking at all of any political website. No blocking at all. Singapore is not into the filtering business the way China is, the way Vietnam or Iran or Egypt was, and so on. Of course, the government makes life harder for internet activists using online media for political ends, but there has been no case at all of a website being blocked. Why has the system lasted for so long? I'm going to run through three possible explanations. The first is that the government has found a way to work with the market instead of against it. The second is a practice that I term calibrated coercion, which has to do with a very clever way of using force when it does need to use force. And third, something that I call networked hegemony, which has to do essentially with the ability of the government to remain responsive to the needs of the people, even as it remains closed to political competition. So first, how does the government work with the market when it comes to media control? This, to me, is was a mark of genius on the part of Lee Kuan Yew, who did fashion the media regulatory system in Singapore. At the time, and so we're talking about the 1960s and 1970s, every leader in the world that wanted to impose authoritarian controls on the media believed that the only way to do it was to take ownership of the media. So nationalization went hand in hand with authoritarian rule. Obviously in China, even in Malaysia, in the early 70s, when the government wanted to reorganize the press, they thought that the obvious way to make sure that the press behaved would be to, at least indirectly, take over ownership of the Malaysian press. So this was the common sense among authoritarian leaders at the time. Lee Kuan Yew, I would say, was at least three decades ahead of his time. He realized that the profit motive, the desire for newspaper owners to make money from the media, is not something that is necessarily at odds with authoritarian rule. In fact, and especially if your government is in the first place a pro-business government, you could actually use businessmen's instinct to make money no matter what the circumstances to your advantage. You could actually align the interests of your authoritarian government with the interests of business owners to make money from the media. So uniquely among authoritarian governments in the 1960s and 70s, Singapore did not nationalize its press. What it did was something, in fact, quite unusual. What it did in 1974 was to introduce a Newspaper and Printing Press Act that seemed to do the opposite. The Newspaper Printing Presses Act of 1974, which still exists today, required newspaper companies to be publicly listed. Right? It required newspaper companies to be publicly listed. This seems extremely odd for those of us who believed in the sort of the modernization hypothesis, right? That capitalism goes together with democracy. Way back then, I mean, now it's easier to understand in the light of all we know, but in the 1970s, it was something extremely unusual and it required a great deal of understanding of the way the markets worked for Lee Kuan Yew to decide on this. Why did he do this? Because he realized that actually the newspapers that were giving him trouble were not the newspapers that were clinically trying to make money from their newspapers. It was in fact newspapers owned by, say, family businesses, where the owners wanted the newspapers more as ideological vehicles, right? Where newspapers, where owners actually had a certain pride in being newspaper owners, where they felt that the newspaper had a mission that was higher than simply making money from. And so Lee Kuan Yew very astutely realized that in order to neutralize this kind of press baron phenomenon, in order to neutralize these owners who felt that they wanted to use their newspapers for some greater good, more than making money, he didn't need to actually take over ownership. All he did was to require the market to take over. So what you have today is a law that requires newspapers to be publicly listed. The maximum ownership in a newspaper company is 12%. So this ensures that, you know, no matter what the individual values of any one owner, that owner would never have any controlling interest. Instead, the driving motivation of newspaper owners is reduced to the lowest common denominator, which of course is the pursuit of profit. As an extra check, they introduced something called a management share, which has 200 times the voting rights of ordinary shares. So this was a way to not intervene in the commercial ownership of media, but to ensure that the management of media, that the board of directors essentially, remained in the hands of those who were trusted. In practice, management shares are given largely to financial institutions, simply because financial institutions have a tendency to be conservative in their decisions, have a tendency not to want to rock the boat in Singapore and I guess in any part of the world. So I know when I present this particular part of the Singapore formula, it tends to generate a lot of cognitive dissonance because it is extremely difficult in my experience to counter the very wide perception that the Singapore Press Holdings is government-owned or a government-linked company. And even when I show people the annual report, look, you can see who the owners are, and Temasek is not one of them, the Singapore government is not one of them, there's still, it just seems inconceivable. And I think the part of the reason why this seems inconceivable is precisely because our minds have such a hard time wrapping around this idea that the pursuit of profit by private owners can, in fact, go hand in hand with authoritarian control. Once we see that actually that's not an issue, it is in fact quite thinkable for private owners to pursue profits in a very politically conservative way, then the Singapore system, this part of the Singapore system, makes eminent sense. The second part of the formula of sustainable authoritarian control on media in Singapore is something I call calibrated coercion. Again, this is something that has been observed worldwide fairly recently. But again, this is something that I think Singapore is way ahead of the game in implementing. This newspaper that I'm showing here is the last copy of, or the last issue rather, of the Singapore Herald, which was a newspaper that lost its license in 1971. That's a cartoon of Lee Kuan Yew lightning striking on press freedom and so on, right? Press freedom, rest in peace. The law that allowed the government to do this still exists. essentially you have discretionary licensing, which means that the government today, if it wanted to, could send an email to a newspaper publisher, essentially revoking its newspaper license, which means that it has to stop publishing, or if it does come out tomorrow, it would actually be a banned publication. Right? So the same law that was used to kill the Herald and other publications still exists today. In the same month that the Herald was killed, four senior executives, including the editor of the main Chinese language newspaper in Singapore, were arrested under the Internal Security Act. They were detained without trial, effectively, for more than 2 years. The brother of the editor, the publisher of the paper, was then detained for even more, I think 3 or 4 years. So the Internal Security Act that allows detention without trial, again, is a law that still exists today. At any time in Singapore, a newspaper publisher or an editor could be locked up without being served an arrest warrant and needn't go to trial. Yeah? The striking thing, though, is that although these laws still exist, the government has been strikingly reluctant to actually apply them. So the last time a newspaper did have its license revoked was this, 1971. That's more than 40 years ago. Right? And the last time that journalists were locked up under the Internal Security Act without trial was also in the 1970s, yeah, the late 1970s, again, almost 40 years ago. So the powers are there, but the government has chosen to exercise self-restraint in their use. Why is this? It's because I think the government has recognized that if you're interested in entrenching your power, if you're interested in sustaining authoritarian rule for the long term, it actually makes sense to do more with less, right? To hold your hand. And anecdotally, we see this all the time. You know, we see that whenever any government oversteps the bounds, whenever it uses brutality to an extent that is too visible, that actually tends to generate instant moral outrage that can be used by opponents, and there's a backlash, right? We saw that in the Arab Spring. We've seen it repeatedly in Southeast Asia, how Anwar Ibrahim's black eye gave a fillip to the Reformasi movement, how when students were killed in Indonesia, Indonesia's Reformasi movement became unstoppable. How when Marcos and his goons killed Aquino on the tarmac of Manila Airport, that was the start of the People Power Revolution. So again and again, you see that it is the overuse of force that tends to spell the death of authoritarian regimes. And the Singapore government has understood this extremely well. So what has it done? It has replaced media closures and arrests with more behind-the-scenes controls, including economic carrots and sticks. And remember, licensing is simultaneously a carrot and a stick. It's a stick if you don't have a newspaper publishing license, but if you have a newspaper publishing license, this essentially gives you monopoly control. So it's extremely powerful economic inducement to continue to support the system. Even when it does use the law, there's been a movement away from these sort of discretionary criminal actions towards civil actions. Sue them for defamation instead of hauling them in under the Internal Security Act. There's a difference in terms of the moral outrage that it creates. Don't pick them up from the streets. Wait a while, bring them into court. The headlines tend to be less sensational. Yeah. So repeatedly, it's used, it's transitioned towards these behind-the-scenes controls. This extends, by the way, beyond media. Here's another sort of graphic example of the difference between Singapore and our closest neighbors, Malaysia. How are street protests dealt with? Right? So on your left, a photo of a demonstration in Singapore. It's like made for TV, isn't it? You couldn't have staged this better if you were for outrage, if you had tried. This, of course, is a gift to any protest movement, this sort of pictures. Riot police, overarmed, attacking a lone protester. I'm not sure when this happened, probably just 2 or 3 years ago. On the right, that's one of Singapore's main civil disobedience activists, the sister of Chee Soon Juan, Chee Seok Chin, who's also one of the leaders of Singapore Democratic Party. This is typically how the Singapore government handles illegal protests in Singapore. Plainclothes police or police in polo t-shirts, women rather than men. So even when male protesters are involved, you often see shorter women arresting them rather than what you see on the left. So it's no accident. It's a deliberate, extremely careful and intelligent way to rob protesters of the moral outrage that is an essential to sort of rile up the bystander publics. Finally, this idea of networked hegemony. What do I mean by that? It's usually assumed, and it's usually is true, that if the political party insulates itself from political competition, it gets lazy, it loses touch with the people, therefore its performance declines, and therefore soon it's out of a job. If elections are not free, it'll be kicked out of its job. But is it possible to have your cake and eat it too? Is it possible for a government to limit its openness to political competition, but remain open to signals from the ground, such that it's constantly responsive, and count on the fact that at the end of the day, most people essentially want a government to perform on the basics, housing, healthcare, education, and so on. I think Singapore government has shown that it is possible, and this seems to be a key part of its strategy, that if it is able to stay in touch, right, in a very, very systematic way with people's needs and wants, and deliver on what they want and need, then it ceases to matter to most people that political competition is near absent. It ceases to matter to people that the press isn't as free as it should be, and so on. And this, I think, is the third limb of its sustainable model. So what you have in Singapore, continued political support for the People's Action Party, declining, definitely. We had a very interesting elections in 2011 when popular support for the PAP dipped to 60%, very high by international standards, a record low by Singapore standards. And the thought I guess I want to leave you with is that perhaps Singapore is better seen not as this strange outlier that is bound to self-destruct, but in fact that it may have chanced upon a viable formula for authoritarian consolidation, right? By working with markets rather than against markets, by using coercion more intelligently, and finally by remaining responsive to people. Even if you remain close to competition, you can actually last in government a very long time. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Cherian, for that fantastic talk. I'm sure we've got a lot of questions from the audience. We'll try and fit as many of them in as we can. If people could indicate and identify themselves when they ask. And I saw the gentleman in the front there.
I wanted to ask sort of you may see if you feel comfortable making this comparison, but between China and Singapore about the issue of the commercial press. Because in China, the sense that the commercialization of the press does lead to articles that the government gets nervous about, is unhappy about, lead to criticism and a lot of things, and that commercialized press has to find new ways to restrain it, but that the commercialized media is very different than the traditional media in China. Obviously, it's different in Singapore, and just wonder if you have any insights on that.
Sorry, could I just ask a question as to identify themselves as well for the speaker?
Yes, Zach Coleman from Nikkei.
Thanks, Zach. I mean, of course, I mean, first of all, I would say that you just can't compare Singapore and China, right? We would be like what is it, if you were ranked Singapore alongside cities in China, we'd be like number 20, so like the 20th biggest city in China, if I'm not wrong. So comparing a city with a country, very, very difficult. The starting points are very, very different. The experience of commercialization in China, I mean, yes, of course it is the case that if you're starting with a system that is essentially totalitarian, right, where the media are all owned by the Communist Party, then any sort of, if you can include popular taste, popular demands in any way, it's bound to lead to an improvement. Yeah? In the same way that TV in India improved by leaps and bounds the moment Doordarshan lost its monopoly and commercial TV was allowed. So it's not surprising that, yes, of course, you find public opinion reflected more in commercial media more than in the People's Daily or whatever. But you know, let us not also forget the bigger picture. I mean, my impression, and of course all of you know the Chinese media better than I do, but my impression is that the politically adventurous commercial media in China are still only a very small part of the larger story of commercialization. That the number one impact of market forces in China on media has been an explosion essentially in non-political entertainment-driven media. So if you think about what is the net effect of commercialization on Chinese media, surely the story is the same as it has been everywhere else. I mean, it essentially turns the bulk of your population politically apathetic, you know, quite content to entertain themselves and much less concerned about the political direction of their country. So I would still see the Southern Weekend and so on as really exceptions. And in fact, when I talk to journalists there, they feel they're, especially this year, right, increasingly that they're still almost on the losing side, right? That now they have to contend not only with the government that is still on their backs, but they don't sense that all the time political opinion is on their side. Often they have to face pressure from conservative, nationalistic citizens who do genuinely get upset when the media are too critical of the Chinese government because they see this as a criticism of China. I've heard the same thing from just recently from Hu Shuli at Caixin, that that she says that alongside government control, one of the threats that to media freedom in China is actually the people themselves. That so I'm not I'll say that there's that is enough indication from China that commercialization will have different effects, right? That yes, it does open up the space for more politically critical media, but on the other side, it also generates a generation that is quite content with and more entertainment choices. And it's still unclear who will win. I'm, I guess, pessimistic.
The president first, and then.
Audience first, I think, but thanks for that very thought-provoking presentation. I'm Tara with Reuters. I just wonder, you kind of ended off with that picture of protest in Singapore. Are there any winds of change developing, and what's going to happen next? Do you think we'll start to see some rattling against the way the press is set up now and change in the future?
There are definitely some pressures for change, and one of them obviously is coming from a generation that is far more comfortable with criticism thanks to the internet. Right? So we've had essentially untrammeled ability to criticize the government online for the last 15 years. And I think this has already produced change in Singapore's political culture. I mean, it used to be in the up to the early 90s that the Singapore government could actually get away with saying things like, you know, we are a Confucian, Asian values-driven society, so people should respect authority, right? And people would either listen to those views respectfully, or if they had no respect for those views, well, they couldn't actually make themselves heard, right? So now the government, I think, wouldn't even try, they wouldn't even dare to make such a claim because they know that the blowback online would be ferocious. Singaporeans now would not tolerate any leader that claims respect based on rank, right, or on position. You've got to earn respect. And any leader that tries to position themselves as a, you know, sort of Confucian authority would be just laughed off the stage. Yeah. So the political culture is changing. Does that therefore mean that, you know, we're seeing the PAP on its last legs? No. I mean, if the political culture is changing, it is possible. It is hard, but it is still possible for the PAP to change along with it. And you do see signs of the PAP trying to change with it. You see politicians changing the way they relate to the public. You see younger MPs trying to make themselves more active on Facebook and so on. So it is very hard to say how this change in political culture will impact on electoral politics. Yeah? As for whether the media restrictions will change, there's no sign of it. In fact, I think so far the picture is quite the opposite, precisely because the government knows that it has essentially lost control of the internet. It guards its control of mainstream media even more jealously, because that's all it has now, right? Of course, many of us feel that that's mistaken, that the thing to do really is to ease up on mainstream media so that its credibility would increase, and that would probably be to the benefit of the ruling party rather than work against the ruling party. But I think the instinct to control is still very, very strong.
There are two questions here. Will you take them both before the chair responds?
I'm George Russell. I occasionally write for The National in Abu Dhabi, which is why I'm asking this. Is this model, if it is indeed the model, is it scalable and marketable to other entities, perhaps Hong Kong or perhaps somewhere like Dubai that's manageable? Or is it something that's particularly unique to Singapore's history and culture and people? And you mentioned the internet. You said, why not free up on the mainstream media? Why not crack down on the internet like every other society seems to be doing?
Do you
want to
take your question as well at the same time?
Or? Okay. Let me take the second one first. Why not crack down on the internet? I mean, fortunately, we started off, with the Internet Big Bang in the mid-1990s with a particularly astute information minister, who I believe spends most of his time here now, in Giorgio, right? From the very start, I think the Singapore government recognized that this is an extremely different medium, and it committed itself to essentially no censorship, no blocking of the internet. And it has, I think, correctly realized that if it went down that route, it would have to create really an army of civil servants to keep track of things online, right? And if for no other reason than governmental efficiency, it realized that was not the way to go. So it has been trying to manage the, on the regulatory side, it's been trying to manage with this the best it can. Because of the online community is extremely vocal, it is quite careful in the way it does introduce new controls. So far, and I'm hoping this continues, right? So far, its practice has been to try and preempt further political activity rather than to try and, what's the expression, close the barn door after the horses, bolt it. Right? So there's been no instance, fortunately, in the last 15 years of the government introducing new regulations that are kind of retrospective, you know, that actually makes illegal something that most people have already been doing. The best it can do, and I think that this is, I guess, what it feels is that the only thing it could get away with is to try and predict, okay, where is this thing heading? can we preempt development in a certain direction by introducing regulations now? So one example of that was when it actually started treating citizen journalism sites in a way like political parties and imposed restrictions on funding that were meant for political parties on citizen journalism sites. So if you set up an independent website in Singapore and you're gazetted under the Political Donations Act, that prevents you from getting funding from external parties, including the many foundations and so on that are in the business of media development. So those of you who are familiar with Malaysia Kini in Malaysia, probably one of Asia's top citizen, started a citizen journalism site, one of the top alternative journalism sites, it would not have started without significant funding from outside. That door has been closed in Singapore. Yeah? It just simply cannot be done. But at the time that it did it, no website was already getting funding, so it meant that the outrage was pretty limited. Yeah? So that has always been the practice, and I hope it continues. And this, of course, also means that, in a sense, the ball is in the court of online activists. It's up to citizen journalists, online activists, to move as fast and as effectively as they can before new restrictions are set up. Yeah? Is the Singapore model scalable? Well, I mean, loosely, yes, we could call it a model, but I would be surprised and worried if governments were actually lining up to study Singapore to try and implement it in their countries. If there is a coincidence, I think it is simply because the same factors that influence the Singapore government to behave in a certain way are also influencing other governments in their own settings, right? They may not be actually consciously learning from Singapore. Certainly, the idea of using the market in your favor is something that's widespread now. I mean, if you look at the way TV is used across Asia, the way TV licenses are quite liberally given to private stations by authoritarian governments, and that it stems from the same confidence, that private ownership of TV isn't necessarily a threat to authoritarian governments. So that's widespread. The idea that you can influence news media through their owners, because the owners have business interests, is also common sense now, right, in a way that it wasn't in the past. So again, I wouldn't say that they learned it from Singapore, but I would say governments are learning the same lessons from wherever they're learning them. What about the idea of responsiveness? I recently attended a talk by a Chinese academic who talked about the Chinese model as being one of authoritarian populism. And that gets to the same idea, where the perhaps what the party is trying to do is to be extremely responsive to protests, to its people's needs, such that the lack of political competition becomes a non-issue. So that as well, it seems to be an idea that has legs. Calibrated coercion, if you look at recent reports by press freedom monitors like the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York, Human Rights Watch and so on, they've noted the trend worldwide in the last few years of censorship becoming less obvious, indirect censorship being used largely through, again, like I said, by moving the action away from the streets, away from bloody crackdowns into the courts, preferably using civil law. Right, using defamation. That seems to be quite widespread around the world now. It is, I would say though that it is much harder, as you use the term scalable, it is much harder in a large country. Because one of the essential ingredients to make calibrated coercion work is that you have to have watertight civilian control of the sharp end of your government, of the means of coercion with force. And you have that in Singapore. It would be unthinkable. It would be unthinkable for a rogue police officer or a rogue military unit to inflict violence on citizens in a way that was not intended by the very top in cabinet. And yet, if you look around the world, that is routinely a problem. Even without a green light from political leaders, you find police officers, soldiers, paramilitary groups, and so on, inflicting extreme violence on people in a way that isn't in the interest of the government of the day, and probably wasn't even green-lighted by them. Yeah? So in large countries, I think it's much harder to exercise that kind of tight supervision on your forces on the ground. Yeah.
It's 2 o'clock, but if Dr. Georgia, those of you who can stay, and if you can't and you need to dash, maybe you might like to step away now. But if we have that one final question from the floor, Dr. Georgia, if that's okay. And Florence, maybe we can talk later. Yep.
Chairman, thank you. Very interesting presentation. My name is David Dodwell. I'm here now as a trade policy consultant, but for 18 years was with the Financial Times here in Asia. And remember very painfully the incarceration of Aaron Seng Kutavan in Singapore in the late 70s. He was incarcerated for a year by the Official Secrets Act. And I remember clearly, too, that he was tamed effectively by, first of all, being incarcerated. Secondly, then being blocked from employment for a two-year period after incarceration. And then finally being tortured in, I think, the most extreme way possible that any government can do, and that is to recruit him into the Government Information Service to offer him the only job he was able to take to do press releases for the government. The memory of that stuck with me and reminded me that the Singapore government is sort of highly attritional. It's very patient and attritional in terms of the pursuit of its longer term objectives. So I'm sure every journalist here will have experienced exactly what we used to experience in the Financial Times. If you wrote or published any story that was even marginally critical, you knew the next morning, in the days when there was only next morning, not on the internet, you would have reams and reams and reams of telex, a commentary, and demands for correction, retraction, and so on. And this continued and continued and continued. There was an extreme rigor at the heart of the Singapore government in pursuit of the most minor transgressions, using the legal system and the pernicketiness of the legal system, essentially to harass busy journalists, busy editors, intimidate them and harass them with simply mountains of material. And I'm sure that the Financial Times and other institutions over the years just became reflexively reluctant to deal with anything. You were just very cautious before you published and then worn down by the legal pursuit. And so that, for me, raises three other factors which you didn't mention, but which I'm sure play a part in this suite of forces that are at work. One is relentless pursuit of the legal system, and a legal system that allows them to do that. Second is management of the education system and a highly elite approach to education which channels a sort of pseudo-meritocracy with some very capable people at the very top. And the third is military service and the effect that that would have had in effectively disciplining the population.
Well, I'll just respond slightly randomly to that. I guess I would say that, let me start at the end. You probably lost me when you talked about military service and the effect it would have. I mean, you have to remember that military service is done by every male in Singapore, right? So I don't think you'll find many people agreeing that that has a conservatizing effect. In fact, probably the opposite. I mean, if you look at, because when I teach in university, the guys come after national service. So they're 2.5, they're 2 years older than the girls who come straight out of junior college, right? It tends to be the opposite. So you find that men have seen government up close through the military and are fully aware of how, excuse the language, cocked up a large organization can be. Most men do not leave national service with a great respect of either for authority or for the system, right? Those that do, I mean, I guess it tends to vary by personality, right? There will be some who go in and swear themselves to be officers for a lifetime. Others see through the system precisely because of national service. So I would say that's pardon me, irrelevant. Yeah, the first two points you raise, I think they capture exactly that transition I was talking about. Arun, the other person incarcerated at the same time was Ho Kwon Ping, who was very successfully rehabilitated in the 1970s. It was a, I would say, cruel part of Singapore history, which I think many sort of young, fortunately, younger historians, filmmakers, and so on, are trying to revisit as part of necessary healing that Singaporeans have to go through. Because if we've achieved success at the cost of individual lives, you know, being broken in the 60s and 70s, then that does not leave a nice feeling as a Singaporean. And I think many Singaporeans are aware of that. Yeah, but then fast forward to the 80s, that's when you are referring to this new mode of managing the media, drown you in mountains of paperwork, get you talking to your own lawyers, and no journalist likes talking to their own lawyers, let alone other people's lawyers. Yeah. In a way, what you're saying is that I think the government's intended effect did materialize. Because if I remember at the time, what Lee Kuan Yew was trying to institute with the foreign media was simply that foreign media started giving newsmakers in Singapore, in particular the Singapore government, the same kind of regard and attention to detail that they would when dealing with newsmakers in, say, Washington, D.C. or London. Right? And I think in that regard, they succeeded. Right? Because as you know, a journalist in the White House press corps, for example, would be extremely careful about his facts because he might lose access, you're surrounded by your newsmakers who are part of your same elite group and so on. And I think Lee Kuan Yew was frankly fed up of the fact that you had Western journalists taking the trouble in Western capitals but not taking the same trouble in Singapore. And the way to do it, being legally trained, was, well, yes, let's get the lawyers after you. And I think, anecdotally, from hearsay rather, I think it is true that the likes of the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones, and so on, and all of them have had legal problems with the government. I think it is true that they treat Singapore as a special case now, right, that requires extra attention to detail. In truth, of course, I mean, the good news is that most of the minefields are actually quite predictable. They boil down to, number one, defamation, and second, contempt of court. Fortunately, there is no contempt of government legislation in Singapore. I think that the government wishes there was, right? That there, if only we had a contempt of the Prime Minister law, right? But there isn't. So they can only go after you on contempt of court and defamation. And I think seasoned correspondents and bureaus in Singapore know that these minefields are actually predictable and avoidable. And so if you look at the last 10 years, the only instances where foreign media have stepped on the mine tend to be careless editing. I believe Bloomberg was the one such case when there was a story edited in New York or written in New York or something, right? So your Singapore-based correspondents and editors would not make those mistakes because they would know these are minefields. So it is not as unpredictable or as capricious as it may seem. I think the foreign media in Singapore have found ways to manage the media. Whether that's a good or bad thing, I leave it to you. I mean, of course, there are many citizen journalists and other commentators who say it's a bad thing. You know, we shouldn't have a system where the foreign media are so accommodationist towards the government. And that's where you find the value of sort of more unruly internet communication come in.
I think all the international media in Singapore have learned where the mines are, so we learn to tread with those. Thank you very much, everyone, for all the great questions. And please join me in thanking Dr. Chair and George again for a wonderful speech.